Go ahead, London.
Hello, NBC. This is David Wills in London. The British are following the story of the fall of Paris in their morning papers with an ever-increasing sense of the need of unlimited help from England. For the last few days, almost every paper has demanded the rapid training of a large army. Some have expressed the reproaches, to put it mildly, that all make, that after so much preparation and so much expenditure and so much public warning against the present danger, we should find ourselves, in England, so ill-equipped. But all papers have concentrated on demand for rapid training, without uniforms and equipment, if they cannot be had, of the hundreds of thousands of young men of military age, which Britain has already registered for military service but has not yet called up for training. There are eyewitness accounts of the embarkation of British troops and guns and tanks for France. These are tokens of the crisis through which British opinion is passing during the present week. The British must expect, according to a warning given last night by Mr. Harold Nicholson, Parliamentary Secretary of the Ministry of Information, that Hitler will launch a peace offensive. Today, the public is informed of Carl Higon's interview with Hitler. Mr. Nicholson said that Hitler would tell the British that their empire could be kept apart from such colonies as he may desire for himself, but that they must abandon their free democratic institutions and accept a government nominated from Berlin, and at the same time surrender their fleet to Germany and Italy. Hitler has prophesied, Mr. Nicholson told the public, that by August the 15th he would have brought England to her knees. That prophecy, he said, will not be fulfilled. The demand for rapidly increased army, the shipping of men to France as fast as they can be shipped, is the unspoken British reply to the assumed Hitler peace offensive. Evacuation of children from London and other cities is still voluntary. Today's papers reflect a growing demand for compulsion and refer to plans for sending children to the Empire for refuge. Several papers this morning comment on Monsieur Reynaud's appeal to America and express their hopes of American support. The News Chronicle, which has for so long been critical of the shortcomings of British policy and preparations, writes this morning that whether the French can still contain the enemy depends on more than France. Quote, it depends on Britain and America. We believe that Britain is now doing all that at this moment she can do. End quote. Today's French communique adds little new to the situation. Here are today's comments by the military expert who is writing regularly for the National Broadcasting Company. Once again, as 24 years ago, the Germans are striking at Verdun. They have captured, whether easily or with difficulty, we do not know, the famous Hill 305 and Motte-Homme, which in 1916 formed the advanced French position on the west bank of the Meuse. This time, however, they seem to have approached from the west through the Argonne Forest, rather than from the north as in 1916. Although if the German claim to have lapped round the end of the Maginot Line at Montmédy is correct, some part of the German forces may have followed in their father's footsteps and worked up the Meuse from there. In any case, Verdun is clearly now in the front line, and whereas Paris was a political and social symbol, Verdun is above all places in France a military symbol. This Motte-Homme itself, after being lost in March 1916, was retaken by the Foreign Legion in the brilliant counteroffensive of August 1917. But today, the situation is not the same. Apart altogether from any infiltration there may have been from the north, that is from Montmédy way, the Germans' rise in Champagne has long passed the front between Reims and Verdun that was successfully held by the French in the old war. The eastern part of the drive claims full possession of the whole Argonne Forest. And if that is so, Verdun is already in the situation that Montmédy was till now. It has become the exposed end redoubt of the fortified line proper. It was disclosed by Moscow radio today that Lithuania had accepted a Soviet ultimatum in which the Soviet government claimed the right to occupy Lithuanian territory with sufficient forces. The ultimatum was to expire at 10 a.m. today, the announcer said. And the Lithuanian decision was communicated to Molotov via the Lithuanian minister in Moscow at 9 a.m. This morning, 2 minutes after the last piece of luggage had been put on board, the United States liner Washington sailed for America with 2,000 persons on board. I return you now to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
You have been listening to London. This is NBC in New York. And now here is an Associated Press bulletin from Rome. The Italian High Command announced today that Italian troops had occupied points of French territory along the Alpine frontier. It is reported that one French destroyer had been sunk, that another was damaged by torpedoes in an Allied naval attack on the Italian port of Genoa yesterday. It added that some civilian inhabitants were killed and wounded in this attack. Bucharest. King Carol of Romania has dispatched a note to President of Turkey asking that Turkey maintain neutrality in order to prevent the war from spreading to the Balkans. Our next report comes to us from the German capital. We take you now to Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is William C. Kirker calling from Berlin. This morning's papers top off the editorials with large banner headlines, quote, collapsing fronts in France, third phase of the Western offensive has now commenced, or Paris and back of the pursuing armies, unquote. Yesterday was a day of sensational news, packed with momentous events, which undoubtedly will be determining factors in the future course of the war. Paris taken Le Havre in German hands, the Tsar front on the move against the Maginot Line. The Italian land forces have started operations along the French-Italian border, and aside from that, Spain has occupied the international zone of Tanger in North Africa. The press this morning is jubilant with the news of the fall of the French capital. Pictures of Paris and profuse numbers are appearing throughout all papers. The swastika proudly flies from the top of the Eiffel Tower. To really drive home the immense importance of the capture of Paris, it is pointed out here that the city as such is the controlling center of the vast net of transportation facilities of France. It is the heart of the government, contains all the chief bureaus of national administration and business activities, and now it, the heart of France, is in German hands. But from what we get here, German troops did not take long to admire Paris, but went right on in hot pursuit of the fleeing enemy. And we are informed that Paris already is far behind the lines. Right down from the Channel coast, down to the Rhine, over a stretch of some 275 miles, the Germans are keeping the front on the move. And what struck me, perhaps as news of second importance, although, the German High Command claims that Montmédy, the corner pillar of the Maginot Line, has fallen to the German armies. By breaking this fortification out of the French southern system of defense, the Germans apparently have opened for themselves a breach from which to fall into the back of the Maginot Line. It must be remembered that in all likelihood, strong German forces, equipped with that mysterious bunker-breaking material, are pushing their way southward of Calon to effect a grand-scale encirclement maneuver which would trap French divisions now holding Maginot Line fortifications. So far, we have had news given out by the German High Command that to the east of the River Marne, the city of Vitry-le-François has been taken, and furthermore, that the southern edge of the Argonese Forest has been reached. We are told that Dead Man's Hill, known as 304, has been stormed. Dead Man's Hill was the scene of the most bloody besiege of the World War in this sector. In this sector, German and French divisions fought bitterly for over a year until finally the Germans had to submit to the defensive strategy of General Pétain, who managed to lay an iron grip upon Verdun itself. Most astounding of all is that the Germans should have been able to occupy this strategic position within such comparatively short time as they claim. Apparently, what the Germans call the third phase of the Western offensive is their effort to smash the Maginot Line itself, perhaps in conjunction with Italian operations which have now commenced along the southern French-Italian border. So far, we have little news in this respect, but we cannot say how successfully these operations have been. But in the meantime, German divisions are pushing a, quote, war of relentless pursuit, unquote, throughout central France. Rumors of a possible separate treaty to be negotiated with France have been cropping up more frequently of late. However, from what I hear at this morning's press conference, officially nothing is known in Berlin regarding such negotiations. In connection with the fall of Paris, it is pointed out here that Ambassador Bullard has not been taken into security, that in all probability he will be shown the proper consideration afforded to a diplomat. It is furthermore interesting to know that the question of material assistance given by the United States to the Allies naturally is receiving considerable attention in Berlin. However, in regards to sending over an army to support the Allies, it is noted here with due satisfaction that President Roosevelt and Mrs. Roosevelt have strongly urged against any such undertakings. Regarding trade negotiations between Germany and Turkey, we are informed that both countries will deliver the same kind of materials as they did before the war, now amounting to 21 million pounds, and this is inclusive of ore shipments from Turkey to Germany. Now, before signing off, I should like to tell you that once more I am leaving for the front. Hello, NBC. This is William C. Kirker, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company.
Again, this is NBC in New York. We have just heard a report from the German capital of Berlin. And now, as we continue our roundup of the latest news from Europe, we take you to Paul Archinard, somewhere in France.
First, that the great battle in progress must be considered as lost. Second, that thanks to the heroism of French armies, this defeat is not a disaster, and the final issue of the war will not be determined by it on condition that the, quote, democracies and the American people in particular immediately do their duty, unquote. In consequence, Mr. Paul Renoir has addressed a last and pressing appeal to President Roosevelt. The reply has not yet come. On this reply depend the important decisions that the government will take today. Let us add that events already permitted foreseeing a favorable reply, and that is why, no matter how tragic are the events we are living through, we have the duty and the right to maintain a strong and confident faith. This quote was taken from one of the most influential papers in France. It reflects the general feeling here, which, taken all in all, is much more hopeful than the Premier's message would imply. As far as we know from latest news received here, the military situation last night was as follows. Having renounced defense of the capital, on the order of the High Command, French troops continue to fight magnificently and are renewing, without respite, a new battle on new positions. They are finding themselves constantly under the pressure of German armored units. The situation continues to be very dangerous, with the German push accentuated both to the east and the west. The German effectives engaged between the sea and the Meuse are evaluated at 2 million men. The French press here points out how important it is for international opinion to understand that the French army has not renounced struggling to the end, simply because the High Command wanted to avoid the destruction of Paris. The battle continues and begins anew south of the capital. The typical reaction of the French people to the capture of the capital is given this morning by a regional newspaper. Quote, although it was reasonable not to link the liberty of maneuver of our troops to the obstinate defense of the capital, the abandon of Paris is nevertheless the most painful sacrifice that could be inflicted on Frenchmen. We feel a veritable physical suffering at the idea that Hitler's armored divisions are rumbling on the pavements of Paris, while heavy Nazi boots are resounding on the Champs-Élysées. And the quotation continues, but let us not chase away these images, however tragic they may be. Let us not be afraid to look reality in the face, even through the tears that dim our eyes, unquote. Concerning Italy, the feeling here in France is that as things now stand, Mussolini and his country no longer have a free hand, that the most probable consequence of this situation is that the supreme command, insofar as concerns Italy, belongs or will soon belong to German leaders. French military commentators foresee the incorporation by Germany of the Italian army and resources that are not negligible. In aviation, in warships, and in submarines, fascist Italy has made a great effort during recent years. These accomplishments will be utilized to the maximum for the benefit of Germany. Today, for the second time in 5 days, the government of France is setting up new headquarters. There is hasty improvisation to keep important services functioning, while overloaded trucks and cars stream in. Personal luggage piles up on the curbstones, for lodgings are at a premium. Luckily for the NBC staff, we traveled here by automobile yesterday and so missed the bombardment some official trains were subjected to in the afternoon. But we had to lie down in a ditch for an hour while a stray German bomber cruised over us further west. And then we did listen to the tack-tack of machine guns very close to us. Last night, we slept in a wheat field by the roadside, arriving in town just an hour ago. I typed the census copy of this broadcast with the machine set up on a pile of grips in the street. Tonight, we shall be on the air from France again for the National Broadcasting Company at 23.25 GMT and at 0400 GMT. This is Paul Archinard in France, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
This is NBC in New York again. This has been another of NBC's early morning roundups of news from the war zone. Today we've had reports from London, Berlin, and Paul Archinard somewhere in France. This broadcast, incidentally, from France was the first broadcast we have had from France in the past 36 hours. Keep tuned to this station for the latest news. More news on WJZ at 11:55. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Here is the noted news analyst, H.V. Kaltenborn, with a summary of the latest developments in the European war. Mr. Kaltenborn.
Good afternoon, everybody. Berlin reports that German troops today captured the town and citadel of Verdun. The fortification line on both banks of the Meuse has been pierced. That is the announcement that comes in a special communique from Hitler's field headquarters. The mention of the word Verdun calls up some of the most vivid memories of the World War. Verdun was the center of the greatest struggle of that war, the point where most lives were lost in a concentrated offensive by Germany that failed to achieve its objectives. And the famous phrase, "Ils ne passeront pas," they shall not pass, has, in French minds, always been associated with the magnificent defense of Verdun. And today, Verdun falls. That indicates, too, that the war has reached a point where the French lines are no longer holding, even when they are established in solid forts. And the German drive is evidently aimed at separating the armies of France, who are now falling back at every point, into three separate parts in order to make their annihilation more easily. That is the classic military method, and the Germans are driving as hard and as fast as they can in order to isolate first the army that is falling back from the channel ports up towards the north and the west, then to drive straight down past both sides of Paris against the army of the center, whose retreat is being impeded by the masses of refugees from other parts of France, and third, to separate from the rest of France the area of the fortifications of the Maginot Line, that line which was supposed to stem the German assault and which very soon will be assaulted from the rear by the German troops that have passed behind it. Pursuit of the enemy, Berlin says, is continuing on the entire front between the lower Seine and the Meuse. Dissolution of the French armies is progressing. More than 200,000 prisoners have been taken since June 5th. The French communique says this: in Normandy, the battle is continuing. Below Paris, our armies carried out with the greatest order the measures prescribed by the High Command. In Champagne, the enemy further increased pressure. Violent fighting is now taking place. In Lorraine and Alsace, there is a violent bombardment on the whole front. The French radio commentator, in broadcasting the war communique, emphasized the part about withdrawals by Allied troops continuing in perfect order. And the French commentator added this: the commander-in-chief, that's General Weygand, informed the French government that the exodus of the populace from invaded areas threatens to impede or even prevent military operations. The Minister of the Interior, therefore, has decided on measures to suspend the circulation of the populace from various points. Of course, we remember that the movement of refugees in Flanders was one of the factors that tremendously hampered Allied operations in that battle. For since they were French people and Belgian people and Dutch people, the French and Allied high commands could not be as ruthless in dealing with those who blocked the roads as the German high command would be. Berlin announced today that the German flag is flying at Versailles. And it is reported by way of Sweden this morning that Reichsführer Adolf Hitler will make an important speech at Versailles on June 28th, anniversary of the signing of the World War peace treaties. And in view of what we know of Hitler's liking for that kind of gesture, it is to be assumed that he will, as soon as it is safe for him to do so, proceed to Paris and to Versailles in order to participate in ceremonies there. It must be remembered that the word Versailles is connected in all German minds with two great historic events. The first came early in 1871, when at Versailles, Bismarck, Moltke, and Kaiser Wilhelm I proclaimed the creation of the First German Reich. And the second event, noted in history, associated with Versailles, is the humiliating peace treaty of that name, a treaty which was enforced upon helpless German delegates who represented the young and impotent German Republic, which believed that on the basis of Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, it was to receive better treatment. Those are the two memories of Versailles that rise in all minds today in connection with the establishment of the Nazi flag on top of the Palace of Versailles. And one might hope that when Versailles comes into the news the next time, that it would not be either the glorification of a new military empire or the signature of an ignominious defeat, but that perhaps Versailles could be associated with something else, with something better, with something more enduring. But even as we express the hope, we must admit that it is only that, and only a very tenuous hope, for hopes of that kind have no right to find acceptance in any human mind today. Early this morning, official British sources issued a second denial that France would make a separate peace. It read, quote, "It is authoritatively stated in London that there is no truth in rumors, presumably of German origin, that France is capitulating or making a separate peace." It was reiterated that France has received every assurance from Britain that the maximum possible assistance will continue to be rendered in every sphere. And as far as Britain is concerned, any German peace terms coming at this time will be left out of court. But we must not forget that Britain is in no position to furnish France any kind of aid that would be decisive in the present situation. Prime Minister Mackenzie King of Canada sent a message to Premier Reynaud of France. He said, "I have read your appeal to the United States. You may be sure the peoples of North America see with clear eyes the realistic needs of the hour. It is my faith that all of the material and economic strength of this continent will be marshaled without any delay to help the French Republic in the great cause for which she fights." Yes, if France could hold out for 6 months, then perhaps even the New World would have time to send something. But is that possible? At noon today, the French and British ambassadors were in conference in Washington with the President of the United States. We do not yet know what was discussed at that conference. There were Allied aerial and naval bombardments of Genoa and Venice today. The Italian High Command claims that certain localities in France have been occupied by Premier Mussolini's troops, that French territory was taken in the Alpine regions. But since no towns are mentioned, the areas are probably unimportant, and according to all the bulletins that have reached us thus far, no important fighting has developed on the Franco-Italian frontier. Italy scored its first naval victory today when an Italian submarine torpedoed and sank the 4,180-ton British cruiser Calypso in the Mediterranean. The official British announcement says that 39 men are feared lost. Italy is likely to achieve most of its naval victories in the Mediterranean by submarine because her navy is especially strong in that type of warship. Another small country lost the remnants of its independence today. To all intents and purposes, Lithuania was taken over today by Soviet Russia. The Russian move was dictated by her fear of Germany. Everything else is camouflage. Russia sees Germany fully occupied in France. She sees a victorious Hitler turning against Russia as soon as he gets through elsewhere. So she fortifies her position while she has the chance. That is why she invaded Finland and seized control of the Gulf of Finland. This Gulf is the gateway to Leningrad, Russia's second city and her first port. That is why Soviet Russia now takes Lithuania under protective custody. Lithuania adjoins Russia's part of Poland and links it to the Baltic. It also adjoins East Prussia and would form a most convenient piece of territory between the more important parts of Soviet Russia and an aggressive-minded Nazi Germany. The difference between democracies and dictatorships is clearly illustrated by this Soviet move. The United States, under the good neighbor policy, could not move troops into Mexico, even though Mexico confiscates American property and tolerates fascist, communist, and Nazi intrigues against American interests. A totalitarian state anticipates any kind of menace to its own safety by forceful occupation. In a realistic world, where force alone counts, the totalitarian method is at once more practical, more effective, and more conducive to the peace and safety of the country that can act. This does not mean that we should adopt ruthless totalitarian methods, but we must understand them and, whenever possible, anticipate them. Those inclined to cynicism may recall today that Soviet Russia made what looked like a generous gesture to Lithuania 9 months ago. After invading that part of Poland, which Hitler agreed to give to Stalin, Russia returned the ancient Lithuanian capital district of Vilna to the Lithuanian Republic. Poland had taken it from Lithuania by force in the early 20s, and the Allies gave the robbery their blessing. Even then, those who employed force were met with appeasement. Now, the same generous Stalin, who returned Vilna to Lithuania, takes Vilna and all the rest of Lithuania with the benevolent protection of the Soviet Union as compensation. Perhaps it is only fair to add that it belonged to Imperial Russia before the Allies started to divide Europe into a series of helpless, self-determining states. Fort Capruzzo, an Italian stronghold on the Egypto-Libyan frontier, has been captured and Fort Maddalena has surrendered. It was officially announced in London today. 4 officers and 100 soldiers were taken prisoner at Fort Capruzzo. This is a minor engagement on the frontier between Egypt and Libya, where the British have anticipated the Italians. And there is a diplomatic reason for that anticipation. Naturally, Britain wants Egypt to get into the war. Well, the best way to get Egypt into the war is to stir up fighting on the Egyptian-Libyan frontier so that Italy will feel tempted to invade Egypt from that point. And the Egyptian government has announced that if Egypt is invaded, then Egypt goes to war. So we must assume that there is a diplomatic as well as a military reason for this action, but it's obvious that it caught the Italians by surprise, that for the moment the British have the stronger elements there, and that they are capturing these minor points. Secretary of State Hull revealed today that several government agencies are investigating reports of propagandist activities by Italian consular officials in the United States. You see, we always have to investigate before we act. Now, on the basis of information that has been gathered, certainly there has been propagandist activities by Italian consular officials. I know myself of propagandist activities by Nazi officials. I have the evidence of it in my house. It comes to me regularly in German publications. So, do we need to do much investigation? Perhaps it's more essential that we should determine how we're going to act. Good afternoon.
You have just heard Mr. H.V. Kaltenborn in a review of the latest developments in the European war. Mr. Kaltenborn is heard over many of these stations each weekday at this same time. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.
There is no doubt in anybody's mind here today but that we are living through the crucial moments of an event which may decide the history of the world for at least a generation, and probably much longer than that. The rush of events is such that we can hardly comprehend all that has happened in the past week, and the future is a blank. We are waiting, as you are waiting. Meanwhile, we look on and help where we can. Look on at the country's heroic effort to adapt and readapt itself to such rapidly changing conditions. Today, for the second time in 5 days, the government of France is setting up new headquarters. There is hasty improvisation to keep important services functioning while overloaded trucks and cars stream in. Personal luggage piles up on the curbstones, for lodgings here are at a premium. Luckily for the NBC staff, we traveled here by automobile yesterday and so missed the air raid some official trains were subjected to in the afternoon. But we had to lie in a ditch for an hour while a stray German bomber cruised over us, and we had to listen to the tack, tack, tack of machine guns rather uncomfortably near. Last night, we slept in a wheat field by the roadside. We don't know where we're going to sleep tonight. Arriving in town a few hours ago, I typed the censor's copy of this broadcast with the machine set on top of a pile of grips in the street. And here is a piece of information just received, which may be of importance for the future. It says that the government of the USSR has just taken military measures to increase its effectives in the Baltic states, and that it has informed the Lithuanian government, in particular, that it will there make an unlimited augmentation of its forces. This is Helen Hyatt in Paris. I'm in France. I am returning you now to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
You've just heard a special broadcast from France with a report by Helen Hyatt, NBC Observer, and it came to you direct from Bordeaux in France. We return you now to Pittsburgh.
Good evening, all. This is John B. Kennedy speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York. Soon we'll hear from our war reporters direct from Berlin and France. Never during the darkest days of the World War was the cause of the Allies apparently so hapless. Not even when the Austrians and Germans routed the Italians at Caporetto, and the French had to rush to Italy's rescue with divisions sorely needed on the French front, and so save Italy from annihilation. The irony of history today is that Italy is keeping engaged on the Alpine front and elsewhere French divisions that might turn the tide against the all-sweeping Nazis. President Roosevelt sent assurance to Premier Reynaud of France that the United States would redouble its efforts to supply the Allies with war material so long as they resisted. He added that America would not recognize German seizure of France. It's amazing how Hitler rough rides on his career of conquest without official recognition of his achievements from this or other governments. While encouraging to the French premier, the president was explicit in pointing out to Monsieur Reynaud that not he, but only the Congress, could make any military commitment, that is, declare war. An NBC reporter previously told us from France that the president's message might well be the deciding factor in France continuing to fight or tossing in the towel. The French government out of Bordeaux declared that resistance against the onrushing German hordes would continue, stating that tremendous losses are being inflicted on the Nazis and claiming repulses in the beautiful Champagne country. A German communique that they had pierced the Maginot Line with an ease that indicates they went through on passes was denied, but not with the robust emphasis that has marked most French denials of German claims. The Nazis also claimed to have seized Verdun, an amazing feat if true. The Kaiser's armies battered at the forts of Verdun for 4 years, and the French rallied to the cry, "Il ne passeront pas." They shall not pass, under the leadership of Marshal Pétain, now Vice Premier of France. At Verdun, even today, is shocking evidence of the intense fury of the battle, in which 500,000 men perished, the trench of the bayonets of French soldiers pointing through earth, in which they were buried alive by blasting shells. Above the Eiffel Tower today, the double cross of the swastika floats, and the boulevards of Paris echo to the goose-step thud. But the Germans have left untouched the eternal flame before the tomb of France's unknown soldier. And in the Invalides, Napoleon Bonaparte stirs in his tomb at this blasphemy of invasion by an enemy he thrashed more than once. The Germans say that General Weigand is about to be replaced. Even that is not necessarily a sign of weakness or defeat. 4 times in the World War, the French changed their high command. Indeed, from all fronts, the Germans are doing most of the saying today, but they still admit the French are fighting on. Even though the historic town of Chaumont, which was GHQ for the AEF under Pershing, has fallen to them. The German plan is to drive the defending French armies straight through France into the hands of the waiting Italians. Nice business, this thing called war. But instead of talking about Berlin, let's go over the ocean. Let's go to Germany and let Berlin talk for itself. Are you ready, Berlin? Come in, Berlin.
Before going to Berlin, here's a special bulletin. New York, the Communist Party has been outlawed in Australia, and all its funds and properties will be confiscated. The British Broadcasting Corporation reported tonight. Come in, Berlin.
This is Theodor Knaut speaking from Berlin. Verdun was taken by the Germans today. The famous fort Vaux, V-A-U-X, which the Germans took and lost in the last war, was stormed this morning, as was another of the forts that surround Verdun. The town and the citadel were occupied by the German troops in the afternoon. The Maginot Line opposite Saarbrücken has been broken through on a wide front. All day yesterday, the Germans reported a continuous bombardment from the air on the bunkers, the concrete fortifications, and all the other strong points of this, the great main line, French line of defense along the German frontier. Today, the attack commenced, and a German communique this evening announces that it was successful. Versailles is in German hands. The swastika flag is waving over the great palace of the kings of France as a living symbol that the treaty signed there in 1919, and which all Germans so greatly resented, is no more. Those are the high spots of the news today, but there is more. The Germans report that the breaking up of the defeated French armies is continuing. The number of prisoners taken since June 5th is more than 200,000. The area between Verdun and two other great fortresses, Metz and Belfort, was attacked from the air. The rearward communications of the French are under fire from aircraft all over France. Lest there be any doubt about the intentions of the German high command, reference is made in a DNB dispatch to rumors of negotiations for an armistice or for peace, with the alleged purpose of distracting public opinion from seeing that the military situation for France and Great Britain is lost. The dispatch says that such things are today not the subject for discussion, but that the remainder of the French and British troops on the continent are going to be destroyed. The same note is struck in the Deutsche Allgemeine Zeitung. An article on the march on Paris this morning closes with the following ominous words. Paris, into which for the 4th time victorious German troops are marching, is now the prelude for the 3rd part of the bloody lesson which is being taught to France. There is no room for doubt that Germany intends to rush the war with France through to a finish with the same completeness with which it began it. Meanwhile, Germany and Soviet Russia have signed a supplementary agreement after negotiations lasting a month for the peaceful settlement of disputes arising along their boundaries. Russia and Lithuania seem to have had a stormier time in their disputes, for Russia sent her neighbor an ultimatum, and Russian troops are to be sent to important centers in Lithuania to assure the carrying out of the Treaty of Assistance and to prevent incidents from occurring. From Holland, which has now been under German occupation for nearly a month, the Germans report that business conditions, which at first were disrupted, are showing a fresh spirit of enterprise. Many factories have reopened, and there is much opportunity for work in rebuilding and clearing up areas that suffered from the war. Furthermore, a demand for labor from Germany is a relief to the labor market in Holland. It will be remembered that numerous groups of workers have come to Germany from occupied Denmark also in recent weeks. This is Theodor Knaut speaking from Berlin and returning you to NBC.
Kennedy again. The puzzle of the war news today is the invasion of Lithuania by Russia. Russia claims Lithuania has been rude in attempting military alliances with Latvia and Estonia. Well, that's much like Notre Dame asserting that Vassar and Wellesley have been rude in plotting against its football prestige. Is the purpose a threat to balance Italy's backdoor attack of France by making a rare assault on Germany? Only Stalin can answer that one, and he won't until he's ready. Lithuania is a quiet, well-behaved democracy, as democracies go in Europe, and they don't go very far just now. Among other notables, the United States has to credit Lithuania with one of its heavyweight boxing champions, known as Jack Sharkey. But Lithuania is not a heavyweight champion in European affairs. It's much too small. Lithuania is bordered by Latvia, another of the dwindling small nations, and by Russia, Russian and German Poland. Its possession by Russia, in the event Stalin contemplates a row with Hitler, will give him a starting spot at Germany's weak point along the Baltic coast. Although it's the grim record of this war that when an enemy attacks what he thinks is a German weak point, he suddenly finds himself on the flat of his back. Lithuania has nothing to offer Russia in the way of material that Russia hasn't got. But in the event of Hitler's victory over the Allies and his reaching out for the rich Ukraine, it would enable Russia to keep him busy elsewhere. Hitler has plans for the conquest of the Ukraine, as a matter of fact. He has plans for the conquest of every country, perhaps including this one. But the Ukraine would be the perfect granary for an enlarged Reich. Those with really inside European information, and I don't profess to be one of them, when the president himself wanted the real dope, he had to send Sumner Wells overseas to get it. But insiders say that Russia cannot afford to let Hitler obtain a complete victory over the Allies any more than Russia could afford to let him have a 100% conquest of Poland. You remember Russia barged in at the end of that German-Polish campaign. Stalin's tiptoeing into Lithuania may be a gesture against Germany, for without any doubt the Nazi war machine, while victorious up to now, has spent very much of its force. It isn't sport to hit a man when he's hurt, but it is war. A war that now spreads from the topmost tip of Norway to the torrid Gulf of Aden. Italy is following in Germany's sea steps by sinking a British cruiser in the Mediterranean and scuttling her own trapped merchantmen. And the King of Italy, known heretofore for his hatred of the war, sent a letter to Hitler anticipating in glowing terms their joint victory over the Allies. While the Turkish president received the Allied ambassadors and gave them some sort of reassurance that Turkey would aid them. In Genoa, Italy, there's a little brick house in a malodorous slum, peering over cobbled hills of the blue Mediterranean. This part of Genoa was bombed today by the Royal Air Force. I wonder what the man whose home that brick house was would think of this strange savagery of war that drops death from the sky when he sought new life over the seas. His name was Christopher Columbus. It's quite probable that if he could see this new horror into which his country is plunged, he would hear with approval that $50 million was voted today for war refugees by the United States Senate. But Columbus would thank God most that he had discovered the relatively same place called America.
And now for more war news, this time from somewhere in France. Go ahead, France. Go ahead, France. NBC in New York calling. Go ahead, France.
Right. And marching enemy troops have been the chief objective. Meanwhile, the Council of Ministers was in session this afternoon, presided by President Albert Lebrun. The Council of Ministers debated on the prosecution of the war for many hours. Premier Renault had conferred with General Weygand beforehand. No statement was made late in the afternoon. No communique was issued. And it was said that the conference would be resumed tomorrow morning. France is living through one of the most tragic crises in her history. Everyone over here realizes that whatever decision is taken at the Council of Ministers will have an important bearing on the fate of the nation, perhaps on the fate of the world. French people eagerly scan their papers for news from America. Well-informed circles believe that a change from a state of pure neutrality, in other words, a pronouncement in favor of the Allies, a sort of non-belligerence, would be a tremendous moral factor in favor of the Allies. A material factor would, of course, be the arrival of munitions, armament, and planes, especially planes from the States. Meanwhile, the French government has at last taken a measure to stop the flood of refugee traffic southward, which has been hindering and, in cases, seriously impeding military operations by choking up roads that are strategically important. Sometimes French aviation and artillery action has been hampered for fear of stopping French refugees. Besides, all these automobiles driving in the same direction over the same road have caused a serious drain on the gasoline supply in the region. Those who arrived too late or who've waited too long on the road before taking on a new load of gas find themselves stuck in some villages where they must wait long hours and even a day or two until new supplies are received at the gas pump. On a motor road down here yesterday night, we were obliged to make a wide detour of 25 miles in order to store up enough fuel to continue on our way. This detour gave us the occasion of falling flat on our faces in a ditch while a stray German bombing plane wandered high above the countryside. On the motor road down here today, and this due to the too great number of refugees, there was a strict military control to prevent any people except those with official missions from passing. Well, the military control has not been functioning very long from the number of cars who have fallen here, somewhere in France. People sleep in their cars, too, and these are considered fortunate, but those who have no cars and who must sleep on doorsteps or on park benches, it's fortunate the weather is nice and the climate's mild. There is definitely a housing shortage in this region where the French government has elected to come and where the NBC staff is obliged to follow. This is Paul Archinard in Paris, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have just heard from NBC war reporters in Berlin and from that familiar place we knew so well during the World War, somewhere in France. This is John B. Kennedy speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York and saying good night all.
Before closing off, here's a bulletin from London. British bombers continue to slash at the German army in France, the Air Ministry announced tonight, revealing that the attacks had extended deep into German territory. This is the National Broadcasting Company.